Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Thea is pursuing her main and primary role of vacationing, but fear not, Lucy Dallas is here, arts maven, digital guru, the heady combination of northern pluck and continental chic. Is that better than normal?
That is my favourite one so intro far ever.
Normally, you just say it's not true.
Well, it's normally not true what you say, but I'll take all of those.
Do you like the word? Do you like the word maven?
I do. Is it completely complimentary?
I think so. Okay. I think it kind of means sort of boss figure.
Oh, does it?
I think so.
Great. Yeah. I have to say, I'm now not completely sure, but it sounds quite cool.
Yeah, maybe. It's very American. I like the word. I should probably have checked it before saying it.
I mean, I've just said it's fine.
Yeah. Arts maven, digital guru, and all that stuff. Welcome, Lucy. The same offer is always available for you, our lovely podcast listeners. If you want a cheap subscription to the TLS, if you live in the USA or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com. If you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19. You'll get 5 issues for just £5 or $5. This week, as our political systems roil and maunder, we tend to ignore that the big issue of our time isn't Brexit or Trump, it's the catastrophe of climate change. Our lead piece this week is by Gabriel Walker, who tells us not to panic. Yet. Speaking of dystopia, last week Margaret Atwood produced her sequel to The Handmaid's Tale amid a flurry of gimmick publishing. Fiction editor Toby Lichtig will examine what's been going on. And one of the messiest couples in the history of literature, and that's up against some pretty stiff competition, is Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. They've just reissued The Great Gatsby and Zelda's Save Me the Waltz, so Joanna Scutts has been reading them and can reveal what they tell us about this literary relationship.
Climate change is very much on our minds at the moment, although it gets much less airplay than, dare I say, Brexit, despite the fact that its consequences are global. The titles of 3 books reviewed for us this week may give you a familiar, sinking feeling. Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? By Bill McKibben. Losing the Earth by Nathaniel Rich. And Down to Earth by Bruno Latour. Gabriel Walker's written a piece for us that is atypical of a lot of climate change coverage in that it offers hope and lessons to learn. She joins us now. Gabriel, hello, and thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Can you explain to us why you say in your piece there is still a lot to play for?
I think there's always something to play for, and at the moment I'm feeling very frustrated with the way that there's beginning to be a bit of a sort of mini movement around people who are saying it's too late, we should effectively give up and just try to adapt to what's already going to happen. And I'm frustrated on that for several reasons. One of them is I haven't yet seen the evidence that that's the case. I don't think there is a particular cliff that if we go over it, all is lost. I think it's a sort of sliding scale of the worse that this gets, the more challenges we have to deal with it. But, you know, there's always something left to play for to stop it getting really catastrophic. And I think also, you know, I'm hearing more of this. Sometimes I'd almost call it cynical chic, It's kind of sit back and look like you're very discerning by saying, oh, you know, I'm a cynic or I'm a pessimist about this, without actually rolling up your sleeves and trying to do something about it. And it feels to me like almost like an excuse to be able to sit on your hands and say, see, I told you so, when what we actually need is all the energy and power of human creativity putting their hands onto this particular pump.
Is there the converse problem, though, that there's lots of people who don't regard it as a crisis? And if they hear that it's not quite a terminal case yet, they'll think, well, it's not as bad as some people are saying, therefore I'll do nothing. All of these arguments for climate change, you can point in both directions, it seems to me.
Yes, you can. So in a way, it almost gives an excuse. You can have a situation where there are those who are saying, you know, on the one extreme, saying it's gone too far, we can't stop any of it, so we just have to do the best we can. And you've got the ones on the other hand saying, all these people are being so apocalyptic and crazy, that proves that this isn't true. You know, apocalypse rarely actually comes. All these crazy people who think the rapture is going to come tomorrow. So it enables them to dismiss it as well. Whereas in fact, the evidence is overwhelming that climate change is real, extremely serious, is already with us. And there's already an awful lot that we have to adapt to. And that if we don't put all our energy into this now, then it will go beyond what any of us can really imagine.
And can you talk us through, because you've got these three very different books that you've reviewed for us, can you talk us through the different approaches, please? There's the, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, you read them. It seems like there's the kind of activism of Bill McKibben, and there's a historical perspective from Nathaniel Rich, and there's the theory of Bruno Latour.
Yes, I think so. Bruno Latour brings a very kind of French philosophical perspective, and I say very French philosophical because it, you know, it's very much in that tradition. And to be honest, Bruno's book is not the most lucidly written in the, or at least not the most approachably written in the world, but his ideas are fascinating in it. And one of the biggest things that he talks about is the role of increasing inequality, in particular the power concentrated in the hands of a very small elite, who he says have more or less given up on in dealing with climate change, or indeed with sharing resources, and just want to grab what they can for themselves and sort of build walls enough to keep out the outside world and keep out the effects of climate change. That's one of the reasons that we're continuing to be in this mess.
And does that link to sort of the idea, we've had a piece in the paper at the Green New Deal, the idea that economic catastrophe and environmental catastrophe are to a certain extent an opportunity to create a new approach to dealing with how we consume, how we behave, because there's lots of people getting a bad deal economically, so they might as well change that at the same time as they change things environmentally.
Yeah, and I think that's another point that Bill McKibben refers to in his very marvellous book. By contrast with Bruno Latour's, it's beautifully written. You feel all the way through when you're reading it, you feel like, I just want to be sitting next to him, having dinner and talking to him. He's a very engaging and lucid companion. So he's the activist. And I take issue with him, the issue of who or what exactly is the enemy. But, you know, in terms of capitalism, he says in the book, there are many on the left who say that the idea is to bring down capitalism, whereas in fact, you know, go to Sweden, it's a capitalist country where they're doing very well on environmental issues and also on inequality. Yeah. So it's not capitalism per se that's the issue, it's how the capitalism's being done.
And the final one is Nathaniel Rich, Losing the Earth, which I've read, which is very historical, but the central depressing tenet of it is almost everything we talk about now, we could have talked about in 1979. And there was kind of a moment when it looked like America in particular was going to get its act together, and then it just didn't.
Yeah. And so that's Losing Earth. And I think it's a fascinating read, especially because I started on the climate change issue in the 90s, in the early 1990s. And so, you know, I hadn't even registered that we knew so much even before that. We really did know. We knew all of the problem and an awful lot of the solutions. You know, looking at the reasons why we didn't act in that decade, some of them are scientists being too cautious. Some of them are politicians deciding that any apocalyptic rhetoric is probably not going to be right and people are just exaggerating. And some of it in the early 90s was the deliberate and very cynical denialism campaign, which all three authors, by the way, are excoriating in their criticism of, and rightly so. It was an egregious set of acts, which is still continuing in some places, of deliberately trying to abuse people to get away with murder. And, you know, I like the way they all write about that. But one of the things I'd say about Nathaniel Rich's book is it's astonishing to remember how little polarization there was then on this issue. So even George H.W. Bush, He said in the late 80s, he said, people who think that we can't deal with a greenhouse effect haven't considered the White House effect. And, you know, it's so, you read that and you think it's astonishing to think that now we've got so polarised, we think it's inevitable, and it absolutely isn't.
Because it's also, isn't it, it's now, it's also become, in a way that it wasn't obviously then, very politicised, completely politicised.
Yeah.
And is it right to say that all three authors, they're advocating collaboration and engagement, but particularly with the people who are traditional or who have been unreceptive to ideas about climate change and what to do about it?
I don't think any of them are advocating that, actually. I think I'm advocating.
Okay.
It sounded very sensible anyway.
Well, maybe they should be.
I mean, Bill McKibben is certainly, I mean, he's a brilliant man and a great leader. He founded 350.org and they've been fantastic at galvanising people and becoming a very broad church and bringing in engagement from lots of different players. So I do think that he is advocating that. But he's very much paints the fossil fuel industry as being the enemy. It feeds into a narrative which is that, you know, environmental activists are the sort of the good guys, and that business is are the enemy. They're the bad guys. They're the ones who caused all this. And I don't think that takes into consideration the fact that they caused it maybe by producing the products, but we all bought them and used them. And then perhaps even more importantly, all of the solutions that we know exist that need to be implemented faster, much faster than they are at the moment, will need to be delivered, in at least in part, by businesses.
I'm interested in the populist argument. At what point did it become a populist position that people who are saying climate change is real can somehow be caught as the same elites who were opposing Trump or were opposing Brexit? It strikes me that often you find a movement, the populist side of the movement, leaving aside lobbyists, leaving aside business, there's a kind of populist cynicism which implies that anyone who's trying to suggest the climate change narrative is trying to get one over the working man and woman. And it strikes me that that populism is very similar to that which you see in other political areas. Like, you do see it in Brexit in this country. I'm sure you see it in sort of Trump in America. And it's sort of, climate change has really been characterised as a left-wing obsession versus a slightly more robust cynicism that's probably more right-wing. When did that happen? And is that fixable? Yeah.
What a super question, and to make the connection to Brexit as well. I mean, I think some of the obvious reasons are that climate change was first brought into the public domain by scientists who are, you know, and there is this kind of increasing lack of trust in, you know, sort of post-truth world where never mind elites and people who tell you what to do and people who know, who say that they know better and who patronise or who, there's a whole flavour of that. But I think also, and don't let them come in and tell you that you have to be a vegan or you have to stop flying planes or driving your cars. And I think that I've been fighting against that narrative for the last few years in particular, because I think that the climate movement has in many cases fallen into the trap of saying, you know, business is the enemy, we need to regulate them, and you need to give up things that you find precious, you need to give up meat or you need to give up your car, rather than saying we need to work together to fix a system.
Is it fair to say that there's an election in America next year? Is it fair to say that that election is a critical path moment? Because you could have someone in the White House who, while pro-business, is kind of avowedly not particularly convinced about climate change, and that will have a huge policy impact. Or he could be replaced by someone, presumably from the Democrats, who would be putting climate change at the top of their agenda. Do you think that, and that's four more years in which that can either be dealt with or not dealt with, do you regard that as a critical moment, or is that more politicisation, do you think?
I think that there's a lot of critical moments out there, and it's a little bit hard to predict which ones might have the effect, might have a good effect or a bad effect. I have a slightly controversial view about Trump's pulling out of Paris, and that certainly the headwinds in Washington at the moment are not helping. But in a way, he almost acted as a galvanizing point by doing that, because individual states, cities, regions, mayors, businesses all came out against it. Even the CEO of Goldman Sachs sent a tweet criticizing it on the very day Trump said he was pulling out. So it's not a kind of concerted countrywide, we all agree with this big effort. And in fact, lots of those, there's a big, we are still in movement in cities and states saying we're still following a path to deliver on the climate goals agreed at Paris, regardless of what happens in Washington. And that set up some big fights. For example, DC wanted to relax some laws on emissions from vehicles, and California was fighting them over it. And the car manufacturers have gone with California, not with Washington, because the businesses are saying we know this is the future and we don't want to waste time having to put money into cars that are not going to sell in the future.
Do you think that, just finally, do you think there's enough will? Do you think there's enough mechanisms in place to enable? Because your response is for people to get together quickly and take decisive steps. And humanity in all its complexity hasn't been known to do that.
So, well, we have, though. We have. That's my point. So I think that, you know, the first point to make is that there's all sorts of areas where that's already happening, and those aren't making it out into the current narrative. So there are amazing alliances out there where groups that you wouldn't consider to be natural bedfellows are joining together and pouring energy into making things happen. And so, you know, there's already momentum. And at the same time, we already have all the technologies that we need to solve this. I think the missing part is the political and personal will. And the people who are saying we don't need to worry about it, and the people who are saying we don't need to worry about it because it's not happening, and the people who are saying we don't need to worry about it till it's too late, are draining energy away from the narrative and the alliances that we need to push this forwards and fix it before it really is too late.
And if there's one thing people listening, and when you speak to people and when you write pieces like this, that you'd want them to do, is it to make demands of their politicians wherever they are in the world that this is high on the agenda? Is there action that individually people can take?
It's making a nuisance of yourself about this in schools and hospitals and businesses, saying what you're buying and why and what you're not buying and why not. Writing to your politician, even in the middle of all this crazy stuff that's happening in the UK at the moment, they get one letter, they assume there's 1,000 more people thinking it. It has much more impact than you realise. It's changed the story. It's not too late to help save humans. It is too late to stop climate change, stop any climate change. It's already with us. But it's certainly not too late to turn this thing around. And we need every single piece of human energy we can get in this.
Okay, that's brilliant. It's official that we're now sending all our listeners out onto the streets to cause mischief.
Do it.
Yeah. We are. We're going to do it and spread the word. Thank you very much, Gabriel.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The Handmaid's Tale was one of the great works of fiction to come out of the 1980s. Margaret Atwood's tale of dystopian oppression, it vividly portrayed the worst excesses of patriarchal power. It was a work of the imagination, but based on abuses that had all happened at some point somewhere around the world. The novel was loved, sold very well, and there it remained, until 2017 when it became a TV show on Hulu, a glossy parable of Trump's misogynistic hashtag MeTooAmerica. A sequel to the book in our world of monetizable franchises was inevitable. And thus the Testaments arrived, heavily embargoed into a flurry of publishing fanfare. We have a considered review, far longer than in almost any other outlet, whose pressing concerns have been for speed, not depth of response. It's by Dinah Birch, and what she thinks is a very personal novel, despite all the hoopla. Toby Lichtig is our fiction editor and can talk about the review and the surrounding noise. Toby, hello.
Hello.
Is it worth explaining, because you see it as a literary editor, how this novel has come to be published, what the plan was and what actually happened?
Yeah, OK, well, I can take you through a brief description. Essentially, it was heavily, heavily embargoed, which is not unusual for a big book. Normally, even with heavily embargoed books, the people working at this end of things do still get the books early so we can get our reviews in when the book's published. But this was denied to us, at least in the UK. It was a different story in the US. We can come to that in a bit. Anyway, Amazon broke the embargo. They released, accidentally, apparently, 800 copies that were pre-ordered in the States. And as soon as that embargo was broken, everyone scrambled to get their reviews out. That the publishers suddenly realised that they needed to release the copies immediately because people were already talking about it on social media. Books were released, and I mean, in some outlets, you know, within 14, 15 hours, a review had been produced. So it was all a bit of a mess, to be honest. I don't think it's done the book any disservice in terms of publicity. I actually think the broken embargo has probably helped because it's, you know, generated another wave of noise about it.
But what's the embargo for? What do they think? I can never understand that. What do they think you're going to do? You're going to get the book, say, 2 weeks earlier than anyone else. What, you're going to start taking pictures of it? And any of you did, well, people are still... it's still not the book, is it? People can still have to wait to buy the book.
Okay, I suppose the point of the embargo generally is so, you know, people aren't going to give away the ending on social media and all that kind of stuff. And it's also because the publication was supposed to coincide with this huge fanfare where Margaret Atwood was going to read from it for the first time. So these are the first words that anyone would hear from it, and it was going to be broadcast in cinemas around the world. And in fact, that is still happening. So I can sort of vaguely understand that, and it's all part of the hype. Why literary editors wouldn't be allowed to get hold of the copies in advance, I don't know. And they were in America, so it turns out, we didn't know this, but as soon as the embargo is lifted, American publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Yorker, they suddenly released their reviews within about an hour. And it turns out they'd all got their copies early. They'd got their reviews in early. You know, the reviewers were allowed time to read the book and write the review. And they were all primed and ready to go. So they published all their reviews immediately because they were there and they were polished and they were done. In the UK, and I'm not sure elsewhere in the world, we apparently are not to be trusted, and that was the reason why all the British papers had to scramble to get reviews quickly done. No one's actually explained to me why these two systems happened. I mean, you know, there's a US publisher and a UK publisher, and for whatever reason, it seems like there's more trust between the US publishers and the critics. It'd be interesting to know why.
There's another dimension, isn't there, as well, because the Amazon... There's all of that amazing hoo-ha leading up to it from the publishers and all of the publicity and our reviews saying then it's a bit like Harry Potter. That's the only thing I can compare it with. It was the same kind of level of secrecy. And Amazon also broke that one accidentally. But who cares? There's no repercussion.
No, actually, the publishers benefit from it, as Toby says, because
exactly.
People chat about it even more.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, the whole, you know, we sign these embargo forms weeks and months in advance. But I mean, as you say, there's no repercussions. It's a bit like, you know, parliamentary procedure at the moment.
Oh, well,
it all works for president. No, anyway, let's not go there.
Yeah, the abandonment of convention.
Should we talk about that instead or not?
No. But does it matter this? Because I went into a Waterstones and I was talking to the bloke who runs it and I was saying, what do you make of the Atwood? And they were thrilled because ultimately... they felt they had a level playing field against Amazon until the Amazon bust it. And so they thought people were coming in, they were excited, they were picking up the book or they were pre-ordering the book. And so should we just feel positive because this is a book by a proper author who writes well and there's excitement about it that does well for booksellers and therefore it does well for people who care about the primacy of books?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm completely on board with the reasons why the publicity machine has done this. And, you know, fair play to them. As you say, the main point is to shift copies and get interest in a fantastic work of fiction. I guess the only negative is the review side of it, the idea that we kind of have to sort of scramble to write these slightly ill-considered reviews. But on the whole, I mean, I can completely understand why it's been promoted in the way that it is, as long as it doesn't take a focus away from the book itself.
But the telly show's already done that. I mean, you know, I'm a cynical person, and there's a part of me that thinks, well, this exists like this because of a TV show, not because of a book. It exists independently of the quality of the book because no one's actually read it at the point at which they're contributing to the hoopla. It's the very opposite of word of mouth, this. You know, when a book succeeds by word of mouth, there is something genuine that courses through it because it means people are reading it, getting excited and handing it to the next person. And that's a kind of beautiful thing. This is the mirror image of this. This is saying everyone has to like this book because the first one was good, it's important socially, and there was a really good TV programme about it. Now, the book might turn out to be brilliant, but the hoopla is unconnected. It is disconnected deliberately from the quality of the writing.
Well, yes or no. I mean, it's disconnected from the quality of this particular book, but it is a Margaret Atwood, and this is a sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, which is enormously popular for very good reason, and Margaret Atwood is enormously popular for very good reason. So, yes, you're right to a certain extent. It will also live or die by its quality. I mean, regardless of the pre-publication hoopla, if it turns out to be rubbish, or if it had turned out to be rubbish, because it's already getting very good reviews, then I think we would have been judged as such in the fullness of time. So there's an element of hubris to it all, but I think in the end readers will or would see through all that publicity. In the end, I don't think it makes too much difference.
And I think if any book's going to get it, The Handmaid's Tale, I think, was a fairly good example of word of mouth.
Yeah.
It became more and more popular and more important and resonant. And I mean, yes, because of the telly, but not only the telly. I think it was well loved anyway.
That's what I'm saying, but in some ways it does a disservice to books. This book will never be judged purely on its merits. It's impossible to judge it on its merits, not least because of the political context around it and the show. Like I said, this show became a representative programme of Trump's America. It was absolutely seen as this. And so Margaret Atwood is seen as a prophet, new inspired, and all of that stuff. I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm saying that what it does do, it makes the book, the quality of book as book, less important.
I don't know. I still think it can be judged on its merits. And you could turn that argument on its head and say no book can live up to the hype. And actually, it would be very easy for everyone to say, well, actually, it's been a bit disappointing because nothing could be quite as good as everyone says it's going to be. I think when it comes down to it, A, critics, B, readers, we're all the same. We'll judge it depending on how good it is.
Well, let's talk about Dinah Birch doing it, because there's a line in this which I find fascinating, and it says this. It's a really interesting review. It's a very good review. It's a long review because she's had more time. We've not hurried it out within, 26 minutes of the embargo collapsing. Her book is written to entertain, for that is a novelist's business. That sounds to me like an apology. For it not being literary enough. That's not like saying this is a thriller that is performing narrative function above anything else. And, we've had many conversations on this podcast about how much I enjoy genre writing and the different, is there any point in saying literary fiction? But do you not think that's a funny phrase? The book is written to entertain, for that is a novelist's business. That feels like it's protesting too much.
I don't know. There is a slight archness in that line, but she's not saying that is Atwood's business. She's saying that is a novelist's business. So she's reminding us that, in her opinion, Dinah Birch's opinion, the first aim of all novel writers, not just genre writers or thriller writers, whatever you want to call it, is to entertain.
I agree with that.
Is to engross us. So I don't think she's just saying that of Atwood. I mean, look, you could... I don't want to get too deeply embedded in the sort of categorisation question, because I know that we can go around in circles, but I guess the ultimate questions are going to be, is it well written? I haven't read it all, but I've read a chunk of it last night, and I think it is well written. There is a kind of a certain flatness of voice, which is something that Dinah Birch refers to. You've got these three first-person narrators, and they do all sound a bit like Margaret Atwood, which, on the level of kind of characterisation, is probably a flaw, although Dinah Birch says it is not necessarily a weakness, but that's a slightly arch phrase as well. But it is well written. Is it engrossing completely? Is there psychological depth to the characters? Absolutely. Is it thematically powerful? Yes. On a sentence by sentence level, it is not the most mellifluous piece of writing that you will ever read, but that's not necessarily something that we all need in what we can call literary fiction. Not everything has to be incredibly ornate. I find her writing very direct and very powerful.
And so should it be on the Booker shortlist, Toby?
Well, yes, I think it probably should be. I haven't read the whole thing yet, so I'm not quite qualified to say it. I am slightly suspicious of this year's Booker Prize. I found its choices pretty obvious. You've got those big names, Rushdie, Shafak, Winterson made the long list, Deborah Levy. You've got the chair of judges, Peter Florence, who's also the chair of the Hay Festival, who's quite pally by necessity with a lot of these big name authors who come to his events on an annual basis, in fact, more than annually, because there are about 15 different iterations of Hay around the world. And I think it's slightly misguided to get someone whose job is to be an impresario to preside over a judging process like the Booker. And then you've also got the former publisher Liz Calder, who was Atwood's editor, who was Rushdie's editor, on the judging panel as well, which just it's just a bit dubious to me. So, yes, I think from what I've read of it, it probably should be on the Booker shortlist. However, I'm slightly suspicious of this year's Booker.
Do you see what I mean about the disservice to the book? Because I just think that what's happened, I mean, we could make an argument that say they just publish this book with no hoopla, in 5 years' time it will have sold 2 million copies. This is my assertion. I'm not saying this is true, this is what. And so although the spike, which is more important to booksellers and publishers, would be greater the more hoopla they surround it with, the net effect of a book over a long period of time may well be to sell the same, and it will be a book that's considered on its own merits. And what we've had here is we've had this strange politicized sort of log rolling aspect of the Booker process. You've then got these sort of embargoes busting and flim-flam events around the place. And what you're slightly losing track of, I mean, Margaret Atwood was in Style magazine in the Sunday Times, I think. Are we not losing sight of a bunch of sentences constructed in someone's brain that's supposed to be something that's worth reading?
Well, I think now that it's out there...
Lucy is shaking.
Lucy's shaking her head.
I've got to be honest with you.
Look, I think if we lose sight of it, that's to our detriment. I think we can all individually choose to make of this what we will. Of course there's going to be publicity. You know, how would you expect publicity departments in publishers to react? And of course Stylist magazine is going to want Margaret Atwood on the cover because that's who everyone's talking
about.
Also, but now that it's out there, I think it's up to us as individuals to read it for what it is.
Yeah. The book is what it is, presumably, and as Toby says and as Dinah Birch says, it's pretty good because it's Margaret Atwood. How brilliant that 80-year-old Margaret Atwood with her fierce intelligence and strong views is on the cover of Star magazine, is on the News at 10, is on the Today programme, is everywhere. Thank God for that.
It's a cultural high point.
It's any sort of high point, to be honest. Yeah. She's also politically very astute, I think.
Yeah, let's remind ourselves that she's not there because she's a famous environmental campaigner or because she was in a film or because she did something aside from her writing.
Yeah, yeah.
She's there because she wrote sentences.
She's there because she wrote sentences. So yeah. I think I feel fairly comfortable about that.
Yeah, we're fine with that, Stig.
I'm just testing because also there's an issue around all this, which is just people just accept stuff. You know, it must be great because it's her. It must be great because there's so much hoopla. And in fact, I would say
there has been. So I've been reading around the reviews a bit. That yes, everyone's basically broadly in agreement that it's a pretty good book and it's definitely a rattling good yarn and all the rest of it. There has been a bit of dissent. So you've got Rob Douglas Fairhurst, who was on the podcast last week in the Times, who called it brash and camp and not as good as The Handmaid's Tale. There was a piece in The Independent which said it was overly neat. Dinah Birch's review for us is basically full of praise, but it's also fairly circumspect, and she does criticise Atwood for a couple of things. And so I think, you know, I don't think the critics so far have completely fallen over backwards for it because of the publicity. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Booker and other prizes. You know, it's not just the Booker that it could win. I guess, you know, now is the beginning of the afterlife, of its afterlife, and we shall see how that plays out.
And how nice that we're having a... I mean, we'd have one anyway because it's the TLS, but how nice that a debate about a proper book is being given and weighed by lots of people.
Yep.
Exactly.
All right, I'm not being that gloomy. I was just checking. I was just testing the ground.
You're just doing your job. Good news story all round.
Well done. All right, Toby Lichtig, thank you very much indeed. Joanna Scutts this week tells the quintessential tale of the Jazz Age, the story of the Fitzgeralds, starring a brilliant, self-destructive golden boy tethered to a golden girl whose glamour eventually dulled into madness. But is it true? What about the account that has Zelda overshadowed, plundered and abandoned by her husband? Are you, in the end, Team Scott or Team Zelda? And more importantly, what do we get from their definitive works, Gatsby and Save Me the Waltz? Well, Joanna Scutts has been reading them and joins Lucy and me now. Joanna, hello.
Hello.
So
great to be here.
It's good to talk about this because it's interesting. Let's start with, should we start with the pervasiveness of the myth of the Fitzgerald marriage? What do people want to believe about this?
Well, I think that's actually changed a little in recent years. For a very long time, it was sort of the story of Zelda and Scott was very much controlled by Scott and his, you know, the way that he wrote about Zelda as the quintessential flapper. He kind of named her as this icon of the time, of the era. And she sort of lived up to that as far as she could in the 20s. And she was the model for a lot of the characters, the women in his novels. And she kind of was absorbed in that narrative for a long time. And then more recently, there's been a lot of interest in her side of the story. There were several novels published even in the last 5 years that have kind of attempted to dig into her history and her hospitalization, the way that she was treated, not just by Scott, but by the whole sort of male medical establishment, and trying to sort of reclaim her a little bit as an artist, as a kind of perhaps not quite as a feminist in her own politics or in her own approach, but certainly as a heroine, a sort of thwarted heroine in her own right as an artist.
There's a lovely phrase you use, which is the messied intertextuality of the marriage. Is it clear who was borrowing what and from whom? I mean, do they both shape each other's work?
Absolutely. Well, Zelda is repeatedly on record as accusing Scott of kind of borrowing her phrases, borrowing pieces from her diary. She famously published a review of his novel, Tender as the Night, and in which she has this line that plagiarism begins at home.
Was that a published review? Did someone say, I know what I'll do, I'll commission Zelda Fitzgerald to review this?
I believe it was published under a pseudonym, but it was a very transparent pseudonym. It's kind of the whole thing is a little bit of an in-joke. But the other sort of end of this is that she was also published as a short story writer and a nonfiction writer with pieces that were published under his name because his name was so famous and they could get more money that way. So there's this kind of very like strange overlapping of talent and credit in the marriage.
And I suppose it's to do with her own work and her ambitions, because Joyce borrowed stuff from Nori, borrowed what she said and sort of arguably great chunks of her diary, but she didn't give her stuff, I think. Never made any claims to...
She didn't have the aspiration like Zelda.
No, wasn't interested in it at all, whereas Zelda... Did you feel that Zelda was trying to claim a place and not being heard?
Well, it's tricky because Zelda also clearly recognised that their lifestyle was supported by Scott and she knew that they needed money and she wanted to kind of keep his stature, you know, for his stature to be as high as it was beneficial to them both. So it's unclear kind of how much she was trying to establish herself in a sort of serious way or whether it's really these sort of bursts of frustration that you kind of see, these sort of jabs at him when she's like, that's mine, that's mine, but not really seriously sort of laying claim to her work.
And she would have presumably recognised the time. I mean, hopefully now we can look at it in 2019 and feel that everyone's voices are equal. But for her in, you know, 100 years almost ago, she'd have felt there's no way my voice is going to be treated equally anyway, that the system's not set up for that.
Absolutely. There is no way she would ever have risen out of Mrs. Fitzgerald in her own lifetime. She was his wife. He was famous and her work would always be tethered to his in a way that his wasn't to hers. And so I think that she was very aware of that even if she had tried to lay claim to her own work, it's unclear how far she would have been sort of allowed by the publishing establishment, by this literary establishment that was sort of set up to raise up and sustain a man like Scott.
Well, let's talk about this book then, because Save Me the Waltz, I've heard of it but never read it, which I feel sad about now that I've read your piece. What's it like? I mean, is it possible objectively as a critic, Joanna, to judge it? What do you make of it?
It's definitely strange. there is sort of a... It was written quickly and it was written in this kind of and it was, as I mentioned in the piece, very poorly edited. It sort of seems to have been kind of thrown out into the world by Scott's publisher and Scott's editor in a fairly sort of half-hearted way. It didn't really sell. And so it was this kind of, they didn't put much behind it. You sort of do get the sense that you can see the novel it perhaps could have been if a really serious hands-on editor had taken it in, but it has so much life. It's a really uncomfortable book in parts. Some of the most powerful places are the way that that she writes about dancing, because it follows Zelda's life story to an extent, and one of the most important parts of the novel and sort of parts of her life was her effort when she was in her late 20s to seriously study and become a ballet dancer, and ideally an actual professional dancer. And the way that she writes about this stuffy little dance studio in Paris and the kind of the rivalries with the other girls and the kind of, but the physical nature of that space and how sort of overcrowded and stinking it is and how women's bodies sort of feel when they're up close and they're sweating and they're kind of making, trying to work on this dance. You know, it's a really visceral kind of description. So in that, that's one of the most sort of powerful moments.
And the dance that she's dealing with, you say it kind of mirrored her own career to a certain extent, because the figure in the novel has to give up, doesn't she? And Zelda also had to give up, but the figure in the novel has to give up for a fairly straightforward physical reason, whereas she had to give up because she was diagnosed with schizophrenia, which, as you say, was much less straightforward and more frightening and less easy to deal with.
It's not quite even as clean a comparison as that, because it's still sort of unclear what she, what Zelda herself was thinking and feeling, but she seems to have turned down this opportunity. So she, Alabama, her alter ego in the novel, gets the offer, the similar offer to dance in Naples as a principal in this ballet company. Mm-hmm. And Zelda got that same offer, but Zelda turns it down, where she has Alabama take it up. Mm. But Alabama, as you say, is physically injured. She gets she injures her foot and then gets blood poisoning, all of which is described in this very sort of physical, pretty grotesque way. But it's something that is a cleaner break, almost literally. You know, she is put out of action by an injury to the foot, whereas Zelda was put out of action by some combination of fear and then this incipient mental illness, which was starting to become something that would eventually take over her life.
There's a terribly sad line in this, which is still mind-boggling, really. Zelda struggled to keep writing and painting within the limits set by her doctors and her husband, who feared her creativity was overstimulating. Which implies that given different treatment, given sensitive, thoughtful treatment, given a more modern approach to, say, mental illness and indeed to marriage, there is the prospect of a talent being nurtured that could have produced all sorts of things, but it was placed within bonds such that that was never an option.
Yeah, part of the treatment was there's a lot of concern about overstimulation, sort of the idea that mental activity over sort of is dangerous, can sort of bring on the more severe symptoms. She's given a lot of morphine in a lot of these institutions. There's a lot of interest in kind of keeping patients very calm. And it was believed, certainly, that her writing was a stimulus, that the dancing and the painting, that all of these things were stimuli. She did manage to keep writing in different times and in different places. She managed to write a play after having been told by Scott that she was not allowed to continue to work on a second novel. So she was doing everything she could, it seems, to have to keep producing in some creative way. But yes, there were certainly strict rules about that.
Well, it's an amazing story, and it's fascinating. I'm going to go and read this book, I think, Save Me the Waltz. Joanna Skitz, thank you very much indeed. Are you going to read? I'm going to read it, I think. Have you read Gatsby?
Yes.
And I love Gatsby. I mean, not for a while. He wanted to call it Trimalchio in West Egg, and she convinced him not to.
I think she was probably right. I was thinking as well.
Could you imagine it was called Trimalchio in West
Egg? It'd get there. It would have got there in the end, but maybe a bit more. Gatsby is a lot.
The Great Gatsby. Yeah. It sounds inevitable now, like all great titles.
But I was wondering also, you know, the relationship between T.S. Eliot and his first wife, and also Ezra Pound, in a way. But it's closer between Eliot and his first wife, because he did sort of work with her. They didn't work in isolation. I'm not trying to say, you know, she wrote The Wasteland, she wrote The Great Gatsby. Yeah. Clearly they didn't. But also, Joanna says in her piece, she says she's not a co-author, but she was definitely much more than his muse. It's a complicated line, because there's a lot to do with editing and you know, as you say, suggestions. And
well, we all want, and this is true of collaboration generally, is true of why we don't want Shakespeare to be collaborating with other playwrights. We want there to be, for every piece of great work, a genius sitting isolated.
But it's just,
and
we know that's rubbish. It's like Coleridge. I was talking about it with someone the other day, and the Kubla Khan, you know, and the person from Porlock.
The man from Porlock on the door, yeah.
Yeah, but that was rubbish. We know that was rubbish as well. That was all myth-making. He did loads of drafts of it.
Yeah, it's romantic fantasy. But we still have it, because someone, you don't want to believe, not you, one doesn't want to believe that things are as messy as they are, perhaps.
But then that's... It's almost like what we were talking about with the climate change. Usually, collaborating with people and getting other people's opinion leads to a better, richer thing.
That's why we have both of us.
That's why there's two of us, and not just me. I mean, not just you.
And not just anyone on their own. That's all we've got time for. We'll stop chuntering on messily now. Our thanks go to Toby Lichtig, to Gabriel Walker, and to Joanna Scutts. My thanks go to Lucy Dallas. Thank you,
Lucy. For having me.
Always good fun. Make sure you're subscribing to the TLS and supporting all our work. Next week, we consider the Middle East, the Bible, the history of modern celebrity. I think we might also be considering some Cornish seafaring fishing.
Cornish fishermen and the social ramifications thereof.
The obvious.
That kind of thing.
The obvious. There'll be plenty to talk about. Thea may even be back too. Until then, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.